Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
All the Bitcoins. Oh, hello there. Welcome to Make Me Smart. I'm Molly Wood. And I'm Molly Wood. I know I totally tricked you. It's like that voicemail joke. That's right. I am solo hosting today. Kai is on vacation. And of course, as you know, I'm not really doing this solo because I have you. Because none of us is as smart as all of us. And then, of course, in LA, I have a whole control room of people here to support me and make sure I don't screw up. Ha! Just kidding. I would also like to point out, for those of you who were listening last week, that if you have spent any time on Twitter in the last few days, you know that Kai clearly did not take Twitter off of his phone while he is on vacation. So you just go right ahead and out him. Just tweet back at him and be like, oh, how are you accessing the Twitter, Kai? Now, several weeks ago, we did an episode all about blockchain. We talked with expert Pamela Morgan, and we also talked to a couple who got married on the blockchain. So if you haven't heard that, you could check out that episode as a starter, an appetizer, an amuse-bouche for this episode. I also have a good video explainer on Bitcoin, in my opinion, Bitcoin and how it works and how it relates to blockchain at marketplace.org. But you still wanted more. And after our episode on blockchain aired, you guys sent us a ton of questions and comments about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, and specifically about how much energy it takes to create cryptocurrency. So today we are going to take a look at what uses all that energy, Bitcoin mining. Kai and I talked to Jun Ian Wong. He's a managing director of CoinDesk, which is a Bitcoin and blockchain publication. Before that, he was a tech journalist for Quartz. And while he was at Quartz, he traveled to Inner Mongolia, which, in case, just as a little piece of trivia, is actually part of China on the border with Mongolia. It's like, Kansas City? It's actually in Missouri. To report, I'm off the rails. Anyway, there he is in Inner Mongolia to report on these very far-flung cryptocurrency mines. He told us all about his experience there, what it was like to meet the workers and see the machines and how little it was like an actual mine. And then, of course, we talked to him about the physical footprint and the energy use for this digital industry. So let's jump right in. So tell us first, you wrote this just fascinating story about Bitcoin mining in Inner Mongolia. How on earth does one of the world's largest Bitcoin mines end up in Inner Mongolia in China?
It's kind of the tale of, you know, two economic booms. You might think of it that way. So this region of Inner Mongolia, which is, you know, an autonomous region in China, it's part of China, there was a big coal mining boom. So lots of coal mines were opened and lots of power plants were opened because people wanted to take advantage of the cheap coal that was available there. Around 2012, the coal mining boom kind of globally kind of slowed down. So there was a lot of excess power capacity. Now, the issue with the power plants is that once they get going, if you shut them down or decommission them, that becomes a very costly kind of sunk cost. And so, you know, lo and behold, enterprising Bitcoin miners found their way there and sniffed out this very cheap source of electricity. And because Bitcoin mining is energy intensive and uses a lot of electricity, it was kind of the perfect match. So that's kind of how Bitcoin miners wound up in that region.
Can we take a moment here for the lay people in this audience, of which I am the layperson? The whole idea of mining Bitcoin, I think we need like a 30-second explainer on that, because it's not mining.
It's a tough one. It's the process of checking and verifying that any given Bitcoin transaction is a valid one. And once they are valid, they add them to Bitcoin's blockchain. However, there's a twist to this whole thing, which is that miners must compete with each other to win what is called a block reward. So a block reward is when the Bitcoin network gives a miner some free bitcoins for the work that they're doing in verifying and checking these transactions.
Mm.
Tell me what this Bitcoin mine looks like, would you?
Sure. It was in a kind of, you know, slightly dilapidated industrial estate. We drove maybe an hour away from the airport, and it's basically, you know, 8 low-slung single-story buildings. There's 50 staff who live there. They live at the Bitcoin mine. And there were something like 30,000 machines that were, you know, turned on and mining Bitcoin and Litecoin. Litecoin is another cryptocurrency. They're basically, you know, empty rooms with no humans in them, with just computers chugging away. The human's function is to monitor the machines, check them for any faults. It's almost like the computers are, you know, the ones doing the work, and the miners, they're and the maintenance workers are really just the support staff.
Presumably in Inner Mongolia, the people who are working in this mine are not particularly tech savvy. But it sounds like, you know, some of your reporting suggested that they became interested in speculating in cryptocurrency after working there.
That's quite right. Yeah, we spent some time with the workers, and they're, you know, many of them are young men in their 20s from Inner Mongolia. And the first thing is, a lot of them are very happy to be working at the Bitcoin mine because, you know, it's safe, it's clean, it's relatively easy work compared to working at, some of these folks worked at chemical factories or fertilizer plants before this, which is far more dangerous for their health. Two, they're paid, you know, above market rate. And then three, many of them don't know anything about Bitcoin at all. They view this as a kind of hardware maintenance job. It's only, you know, after getting the job that they start kind of reading up on it. And some of them have, you know, tried to dabble and buy a bit of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies of their own. But, you know, they're not Bitcoin enthusiasts by any stretch of the imagination.
So talk to us about the electricity factor. Here you have these racks and racks and racks of machines, and they're working. And it's this huge energy suck. How much energy is really being used there? And then can you explain to us sort of why it actually requires so much energy?
Sure. So when we went in, you know, August of last year, August of 2017, they told us that they were paying a electricity bill of $39,000 a day. And that was with a discount from the power supplier. That translates into enough energy for 12,000 homes on average, U.S. homes. So it's definitely a huge source of energy use.
Is it a sustainable source of energy use? Because you could see how it would just eventually suck up all the coal power in Mongolia and then hydropower in the rest of China and eat up the world's energy supply because we all want Bitcoin.
I think it's important to note that a lot of the electricity being consumed now is surplus to requirements. So, you know, the Chinese Bitcoin miners, they have, for example, the ones in Inner Mongolia, they're using energy that from power plants that were set up during a boom and so are currently surplus to requirements. They're not, that electricity is not being used for anything useful anyway, which is why the power companies want to sell it for cheap and the Bitcoin miners want to buy it for cheap to keep their costs down. And the same is true of hydropower plants, right? In China, the miners are quite interesting in that some of them are seasonal. So during the summer months, they actually move to the eastern provinces of China where there's a lot of hydroelectricity. And then in the winter months, because it gets too cold and the hydro is not as effective because of all the ice, they actually pack everything up and they move back to Inner Mongolia to tap into the stable coal-fired electricity.
Wow.
So they're kind of like migratory birds in a way.
I have so many questions, but I guess my biggest one is, while the technology works, right, while blockchain and Bitcoin, they exist, and sure, I can buy a Subway sandwich at the local Subway with Bitcoin, that's great, but the market isn't really there yet for the product these guys are creating, you know?
Sure, and, you know, I think there's a bit of a circular logic here at work, which is, you know, why would you want to get involved in Bitcoin mining unless Bitcoin, the Bitcoins that you were mining were worth a lot.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's, I don't think any, even the most kind of enthusiastic supporter of cryptocurrencies would be hard pressed to say that speculation is not rampant in these markets. Mm. But because of that speculation, people are now willing to essentially gamble or bet by buying all of this Bitcoin mining equipment that indeed those virtual coins will be worth something.
Hmm.
How do you know, this might be a little in the weeds, but we know that you know, there's a finite amount of Bitcoins that can ever be created, at least Bitcoin specifically, that currency, no more than 21 million. And at least
sorry,
as
wait,
of 2017.
Wait, sorry, is that 21 million total Bitcoins?
Yep. Yep.
Okay, at whatever the valuation is. Okay, got it. Sorry.
At whatever the valuation is, exactly. And so the mining process accelerates that. We know that as of 2017, I think there were about 17 million that already been created. Presumably, as the mining increases, the mining volume, what is the incentive to keep mining when all the Bitcoins have been created? Right. What happens then?
The answer is transaction fees. So contrary to popular belief, Bitcoin transactions are not free of charge. In a way, they're currently subsidized by the block reward, which the miners earn for doing all this work to verify the transactions. Therefore, fees currently are very, very low and often not noticeable. They might be a few cents, for example. So in the world, I think it's I don't remember the exact date. I think it's 2100, about, you know, 80 years from now, when all the Bitcoins have been mined, then, you know, presumably that would be a world where Bitcoin is very widely used and Bitcoin transactions have some value attached to them. And therefore, fees can sustain the miners.
One thing to note about the fees is that they have been their own kind of, this is Molly, by the way, back from the interview. The fees have been a bit of their own bugaboo for Bitcoin. They are almost as volatile as Bitcoin itself. So in, let's say, mid-December, the very end of 2017, the median fee was $34 for any transaction involving Bitcoin. So if you were paying just a fraction of a Bitcoin for like a coffee and the fee was $34, obviously you were not going to buy that coffee or your Subway sandwich. Now, at least as of February 2018, in fact, I shouldn't even say now because anything could have happened between February and now, it was more like a dollar, about 74 cents. It's kind of all over the place. And so there are efforts to create new kinds of networks that will help to stabilize those fees, which we may end up doing a future episode on. But he was kind of chill about the fee thing. But until that is solved, it is going to be a pretty hard way for Bitcoin miners to make money, because if the fees are so high that people don't use Bitcoin, then obviously everybody's out of business. All right, next version of the Bitcoin conversation is that once you have mined them, you have to figure out what to do with them. Lots of people obviously are trading Bitcoin, as in buying and selling. In fact, you could argue that Bitcoin at this point is essentially much more than a currency. It is actually an asset class. But it's an emerging market, and so no one has really classified Bitcoin in terms of how it should be traded as an asset class. Is it a security, which follows all the rules set forth by the Securities and Exchange Commission for stocks and bonds? Is it a currency? Is it a commodity? And this lack of classification is really scary for investors because it's, as we know, almost completely unregulated right now. So if Bitcoin prices fluctuate, which they obviously do all the time, investors aren't protected. And so investors and regulators now are trying to figure out how to classify Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as they evolve. Like the SEC has said, we don't think Bitcoin is a security, but other types of cryptocurrency might be. So on Marketplace Tech, to try to unravel this, I talked to New York Times crypto reporter Nathaniel Popper to get his thoughts. He wrote a book called Digital Gold, Bitcoin and the Inside Story of the Misfits and Millionaires Trying to Reinvent Money. And I asked him how he thinks Bitcoin should be categorized.
commodity is probably a pretty good description for what it is, but you've had other agencies that have called it different things. You know, again, you had the SEC sort of talking about it as money. The IRS has called it property. That you hear digital asset. So it's all, you know, everybody's sort of trying to get their heads around how to think about this and what rules should apply to it.
And of course, just as a tangent, the funny thing about trying to classify Bitcoin as a commodity is that a commodity usually is a real thing, like a pig or gold or wheat. And so you can see the level at which people are trying to get their heads around this. Other countries are taking different approaches when it comes to crypto. Bitcoin mining is technically legal in China, but trading it is not. So we tried to dig in with Nathaniel on what's going on in the U.S. along those lines. And regulators also have not exactly figured out what Bitcoin should be.
The U.S. government has never really, I think, developed a plan to deal with the rise of this whole crazy technology. The U.S. government has been generally just very reactive. You know, when a problem has come up, they have sort of figured out the rules that were necessary to deal with that problem. I think part of the problem is that there isn't a sort of template for how to deal with this. You know, there isn't, this hasn't happened before. You haven't had a whole new asset class come into being where you had to sort of figure out who was responsible for it. That the government has put a pretty heavy priority on saying, we don't want to stop this innovation. We think there's something important here, and we're worried that if we put new rules on all of this, put the wrong new rules on this, that it might stop the innovation and drive this overseas, or just stop it altogether.
Now, of course, while we're in this innovation stage, it's pretty wild westy out there, since nothing about this has been classified or exactly all the way regulated. So I asked Nathaniel if he has any advice for people who want to venture into this wild and woolly situation.
You really have none of the protections that you have in any other financial markets. And that's sort of the scariest thing about it. Of course, that's, you know, risk and reward is supposed to be in inverse relation, and you have that, you have had that here in the past. But I think, you know, part of the concern is that if you continue having these sort of blow-ups and hackings and so forth, that eventually people are not going to want to come back to this, and that is going to hurt the long-term value if investors realize that this is a place in which they are completely exposed. At some point, they're not going to keep coming back and buying this.
It was a super interesting conversation. That was the gist of it. But as you can see, and as we have seen from all of your questions and responses to every time we talk about this, there's an endless well of details, minutiae, questions, and curiosities about Bitcoin and blockchain. So keep them coming. We welcome your questions and comments about this topic, other directions you'd like to see us go. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. You know we love your voice memos, and we're going to hear a bunch of those in a little bit. But first, we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Not everyone gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully a little bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy. And that's good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors. And thank you. And now it is time to hear from you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
Hi, Al Groves from Lawrenceville, Georgia.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, let's start off with one of our many, many questions about blockchain and Bitcoin. Rain Mar Tejera from Panama City, Panama, sent us this voice memo about blockchain hacks.
Why is it that whenever somebody espouses the marvels of blockchain, be it at a TED Talk, a podcast, your podcast, I turn around and run into a news item that tells me that some cryptocurrency exchange was hacked and that thousands and thousands of dollars just vanished. And it seems to me that blockchain, like any other software system, is very hackable. I would really like to hear your opinion on the matter.
That's a great point. And you are correct, Rainmar, that while it's unclear the level at which the ledger itself, right, blockchain or any actual individual, say, coin can be taken apart to its component parts, like that's not necessarily happening. But all the exchanges, all the kind of external systems that give access to cryptocurrencies are, of course, vulnerable to hacking, just like any other digital system. I mean, someone can also take a hundo out of your wallet. So it's sort of, it's kind of in that category in terms of hackability. But as someone who lost what at various points in the Bitcoin timeline could have been as much as $5 million in Bitcoin to hacking, yeah, you're not wrong. It's a problem. All right. David Hannigan from Denver sent us this voice memo about blockchain and journalism.
Much like many other people in the Denver area, I was very concerned to hear about the erosion of local journalism, particularly with the Denver Post and its hedge fund owners. Of course, they reduced their staff. And now, until last week, when I heard that there would be a new local paper from many of the former staff of the Denver Post, only this time it's called the Colorado Sun and it will be based on blockchain technology. Okay. Cool. So my question is this. Do you think that this sort of blockchain technology can save local journalism? Or is it just a gimmick, like many other venture capital experiments that we've seen and that have failed?
Oh, man, that I have roughly the same response to that. The only thing that I can say to you in response, David, is I think we should probably get those Colorado Sun people on the show and have them explain to us how in the bejesus a newspaper operates on blockchain technology. There is going to be a tendency, much like there is with AI right now, just put an AI in it and then it's a better product. There's definitely going to be this tendency to put everything on the blockchain, and I don't know what that's going to look like or do. It's one of the things Pamela Morgan talked about with us a little bit, which is that it does start to feel like maybe that's the move of somebody who doesn't totally understand how it works. But I'm open to the possibility they know something that we do not. And finally, we asked you all on Twitter and Facebook to let us know when you have seen Bitcoin in the wild, and you responded. We got so many great photos, emails, stories. We will be sharing some of those on Facebook. You might see some pop up on Twitter. And honestly, keep them coming. Ron Buencamino left us this voice memo about having seen two Bitcoin ATMs in, no surprise here, the Bay Area.
There's a Bitcoin ATM at the Valley Fair Mall here in Santa Clara, and though I've walked by it a number of times, I have yet to see anybody actually using it. I also had ramen at a restaurant in Japantown in San Francisco, and they accepted Bitcoin as a method of payment. And though I didn't have any Bitcoin at the time, I really would like to try it out at some point.
I like that he makes it sound like I left my wallet at home. I didn't have my Bitcoin with me that day, so I couldn't do it. By the way, these questions about Bitcoin ATMs have raised a lot of questions about how Bitcoin ATMs work. We have likened them in the pre-show to something like Coinstar. Like, you can put money in and buy a Bitcoin at a kind of an absurd fee, or you can cash out your Bitcoin also for an absurd fee. But it feels like that might be a future explainer as well. Maybe we could do it in the same episode where we talk to the Colorado Sun people about the newspaper on the blockchain. All right, listener Henry, who does not want his last name used, told us that he spotted what looked like Bitcoin at a diner, but then he looked a little bit closer.
So my wife and I were in Ironwood, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. And we were visiting Joe's pasty shop when we saw this little sign that said Bitcoins, $20. And I was kind of intrigued, so we asked to take a closer look and saw these four metal discs that were being sold, I guess as Bitcoin commemorations or souvenirs or something. I had to explain to another person at the counter that these, in fact, were not actually Bitcoins.
You know, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is an emerging industry that is rife with fraud and scams, and buyers should beware. There are many ways in which you will need to protect yourself if you want to play this game. I did not think that one of those ways would be somebody trying to sell you actual pieces of metal and calling them Bitcoin. That's a dirty trick. Although I do love pasties. Omar Branson Zaki left us this voice memo of his sighting in Georgia.
I recently took a photo of a Bitcoin sold here sign in the window of a gas station on Memorial Drive in Atlanta. I love the other signs in the window. The Bitcoin sign sits between an ad for the Georgia Lottery, a pay your bills here sign, and an ad for hot boiled peanuts.
Okay, that's awesome. That is atmospheric, Omar. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who sent in reports and photos and voice memos about their sightings. Kind of keep them coming because we can't get enough. And keep your other questions coming, your comments. I know that we all miss Kai. He will not be here next week either, but we'll still have a show for you. Don't worry. Don't panic. It's going to be great. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can tweet me @MollyWood. And apparently you can also tweet Kai, even though he's supposed to be on vacay. See you next week. Our show. Please subscribe, give us a review on Apple Podcasts, tell your friends. And if you have not tried it out yet, and maybe you bought yourself, I was going to say maybe you bought an Amazon Echo on Prime Day, but Amazon wasn't working that day. Anyway, if you have an Amazon Echo or any Alexa device, say, Alexa, make me smart, and see what happens. You'll get a little explainer from me or Kai. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday and Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Tara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I did it. There's tons of music left. Didn't even have to hurry. Bye.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.